I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Hello and welcome. It's our bonus Q&A episode of our Books of the Year podcast in the studio with Sir Ian Rankin. If you want to hear him talk about Midnight in Blue, that's in our other podcast, which came out just a few days ago. So, Ian, first question, as ever, same as it ever was, what is the last book that you really, really enjoyed reading?
Well, I really enjoyed Louise Minchin's Isolation Island.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a game show gone badly wrong. It's gone badly wrong. It's one of these reality shows where a lot of celebs are taken to an island off the west coast of Scotland. They've got to live as monks. So that all their possessions are taken away. They're given cowls and they're told, you're going to go and live in this abbey for a few weeks. And all these cameras are on you. And very quickly, it all goes badly wrong. People start disappearing. People start dying. There's a storm, so there's no way for anybody to get there and rescue them. And she did it really well. I mean, it really gripped me.
I just watched the TV adaptation of The Name of the Rose, which was a few years ago. But James Turturro in the lead role and Rupert Everett playing Bernardo Gui, having the best time of his life. If you get a chance to see it, it's absolutely fantastic. Okay, so that's Louise Minchin.
So do you have a writing routine, Ian, or what is it, but has it changed over the years?
The routine has changed to the extent that I can't write for the length of time I used to write. I would sit down as a young man and write for 10 hours straight.
You know, ten hours straight?
Yeah. I wouldn't even stop for lunch. I would just keep going. And I would write, you know, about 30 pages a day, which is about 10,000 words. Is that right? 30 pages times 300 words? Yeah. A day. No problem. And now I work for half an hour to 40 minutes. I'm absolutely gone. And I've got to go up, walk around, get a breath of air, make a cup of tea. I can do that a few times in a day, but so I'm really slowing down. The fingers are getting gnarly. My fingers look like Keith Richards' fingers now from doing too much hitting a typewriter or hitting a keyboard. My brain can't. I used to keep everything in my head. I didn't take lots of notes, and I kept all these plots and characters and subplots in my head, and I'm finding that much harder. But routine-wise, you know, I get panicky that I need to deliver a book by a certain date. Then I sit down, I start writing. I write the first draft very quickly. I then revise and hand it over to my wife, who goes through it with a pen and marks up the things I've got wrong. And it gets, so I take on board all the changes she requests before it goes to my editor.
Can you ever imagine not writing?
Yeah. I'm the laziest hardworking writer I know. You know, I was once called Stakhanovite, which means a hard worker for the state in Russia, communist Russia. Anyway, but no, I can go weeks and months at a time without writing, which is why I then get into a panic because the deadline is looming. And, you know, I go to the pub and I do the crossword and I listen to music and I go on holiday and that's all great. But, in the modern world, the writer spends more time being a writer than they do writing. Being a writer, doing podcasts, doing your socials, going out on tour, meeting people, all of that. When I was young and unknown, I could just write nonstop because there was nothing else demanding my time.
Yeah, I just wanted to Lee Child, who's been on this show a number of times. His approach. No, I've got to 65 and I'm retiring because that's the way I was brought up. You get to a certain age, you retire. It's fine. I'm walking away.
And you know what? I'll be 65 in April next year. And he caught my attention with that. And I thought, yeah, you know, I don't. You know, nobody wishes they'd spent more time in the office in their final days on earth. I'm just thinking, my dad retired at 65, died at 72. So maybe next April is when I say, well, Ian, you know, is there anything else you want to do? Facilitated by the fact that I am currently out of contract. So this book was the final book of a contract. No. My wife said, don't sign another contract. She said, if you got a great idea for a book somewhere down the line, sit and write the book. But don't write a book because you have to, because you've got a contract.
Next question. Have you ever had a mentor?
A mentor? No. Well, I mean, I've never been to a creative writing class in my life. When I was young, when I first went to university, I was a poet. I had the tweed jacket and the pipe and everything. I was prepared to be a full-time poet.
You go back.
And yeah. And so there were poets that I would sort of meet up with and rub shoulders with and ask questions of, and they would sometimes be helpful. Then I was a writer in residence at Edinburgh University, a fiction writer called Alan Massey. He was hugely helpful to me in the early days, not in terms of giving me feedback on my stuff, but just point me in the direction of publishers and places where I might get published. So he was very useful. But that's about as far as it goes. Probably Alan Massey, when I was in my early 20s, would have been my mentor.
We've talked about writing. What about reading? Can you read anywhere? Do you have a favourite place to read?
I read in bed. And I read, you know, if I'm travelling, I'll read on trains, planes, actually not car. I can't read in cars. Mm. I get car sick. But planes and trains are fine places to read. Holiday is great for reading. I'll take half a dozen books with me. Physical books. I don't do the e-book thing. Sitting in my office. My office is basically a flat. It's an apartment, but one tiny room is where my computer is, and in this huge living room is where my hi-fi system is, and that's where I sit with my feet up when I'm not writing, and I stick a record on, and there's a big pile of unread books,
and a big pile of vinyl,
huge pile of vinyl. Too much. My wife said no. I can't. But I did get rid of a lot of vinyl when we downsized, and I've just started buying it back again.
I'm going to ask you a bit about that in a moment. We like to surprise our guests, if we can, with a question from a fellow author and fan. So you'll need your headphones on for this. Here is a voice note from fellow crime writer, the Reverend Richard Coles.
Hi, Ian. Richard Coles here. Just wondering if you could let me know the secret of writing a long-running and highly successful murder series. Asking for a friend.
I think he's just got up.
Yes.
Or he's just going to bed. Or he's had a couple of swift malts.
Yes. You know, the Reverend Richard Coles used to be a prison chaplain. If I had known that when I was writing my Rebus novel set in prison, I would have asked him for some advice and I would have put a chaplain in there. There is no chaplain in my books. I never met one while I was visiting. Is there a secret? I'm not sure. I mean, you need a charismatic main character, I think, or a cast of characters who people want to hang out with for a while. You've got to find things for them to do. You've got to keep interested in them. It helps if they change, if they age. So, you know, Rebus ages in real time, and that means he's different for me in every single book. He's never quite the same twice. It helps if you've got a really interesting location that you can use that you're not going to get tired of. So small villages don't always do it because there's not enough going on. They don't seem to change. Whereas a big city, you've got change all the time. So that keeps you on your toes and it keeps you interested. But you've just got, you know, you've got to want to keep writing these books. You've got to want to write a long running series. And the reason I've ended up doing it, I didn't intend to write a long running series, but it's the best way I've found of writing about Edinburgh and Scotland as a microcosm for the world and all the big issues that are happening around us, all the social issues and the big moral questions can be contained in this book if you give yourself enough time and enough pages.
You've talked already about writing to deadlines. How are you with deadlines? Do you find some structure with them, or do you fear them, or do you completely ignore them?
I love them. I can't really do anything without a deadline. I used to be a journalist. I mean, I used to work on a monthly music magazine in London and always to deadline. And I just got used to writing to deadline. And a lot of journalists who are now writers, of course, are very good at deadlines. You know, I've never missed a deadline yet for publication purposes. And it just, that panic sets in. And when the panic sets in that a deadline is approaching, then the adrenaline gets going and suddenly you find the answers to questions and you find the impetus to get the book done. I'm not a Douglas Adams. You know, he said, I love deadlines. I love the whooshing sound they make as they go past.
Apparently a nightmare.
Well, I know they had to lock him in hotels and things to get him to finish books, yeah. Nobody's ever offered to lock me in a 5-star hotel to finish a book. Maybe I should start missing those deadlines.
I want to ask, so I'm changing this question. Have you ever heard of, this sounds like a band that Rebus would hate, have you ever heard of Swedish Death Cleaning?
Is it a real thing?
It is a real thing.
Okay.
It's basically, you get to a time of life and you realize that nobody wants your stuff, and you start to go, okay, we don't need that, and it's going. And I've just gone through a whole stack of books because I've just got there's too many. It's just like overflowing in every single room of the house. I heard someone say, you have to realize that nobody wants your stuff. Yeah. Your kids might have one or a handful of records, but they're not going to. So this apparently is called Swedish Death Cleaning. And it's sort of, I suppose it's sort of just something that you do in the last 20 years of your life or so. You just start getting rid of it. Does that ring any bells with you?
Yeah. I mean, when we downsized from a very big detached house to a three-bedroom flat, we had to get rid of a lot of stuff. A lot of DVDs had to go. A lot of books had to go. A lot of LPs and CDs had to go. A lot of stuff had to go. So that was part of it. And we thought, this is great. We're not leaving that job for our kids. Having done that, my wife's mother passed away, and she was an academic, as was her husband, who predeceased her. Suddenly, 50-odd boxes of books arrived, because in her will, she said, Miranda, my daughter is getting my books, our books. 50-odd boxes, big boxes of books arrived in our small flat. So we are now living in Steptoe in son's front yard, basically. So having decided to downsize and everything else and get rid of stuff, we've now got another problem on our hands.
Is this the universe trying to tell you something, that you try and get rid of these books, but they're going to find their way back?
And yeah, you know what? And you go, well, but these are personal things. You know, her parents were academics. The books are scribbled in the margins, or written little notes and things. And you go, you can't possibly give those away. What can you do with them? So what you do is you go to IKEA and buy lots more bookcases.
Have you ever tried to impress someone with a book? Not necessarily one of your own, but or maybe is one of your own.
Oh, I'm always trying to impress people with books. I've got, what have I got? In fact, the books that arrived from my wife's mother included first edition pamphlets of the Four Quartets by T.S. Eliot. And I'm a huge fan of Four Quartets. To actually see the first pamphlets, which were published during the war, so the paper quality decreases as the war goes on. So the first two or three are in pretty good paper. By number four, which was 1943-44, the paper quality is dreadful. So really interesting. And so those, I think, are prized. I mean, my signed copy of Miss Jean Brodie by Muriel Spark is currently in a part of an exhibition. So I was very happy to give that away to an exhibition so people can see that she signed a book to me. I've got a signed Keith Richards autobiography that I'm very proud of. Probably got more signed records than books, actually. But I've got some. I've got Alistair Gray, who was a wonderful Scottish novelist. I hung out with him for a while in my early days. And not only did he sign books to me, but he drew my portrait in a couple of them.
That's not bad.
Yeah, those are lovely. I do like those. And, you know, books by people like Ian Banks, who are no longer with us. Those are the ones you treasure.
These are books that you are not going to get rid of at any time.
Never, never, never.
Now, do you have a favourite... So the next question is whether you have a favourite screen or stage adaptation of a book. This could be one of your books, or it could be any book. And the reason I just want to add something to it is when Robert Harris was on just a couple of weeks ago talking about Precipice, he had just seen, as I have actually now seen, there's a new screen adaptation of Conclave, the vote to be a pope, starring Ralph Fiennes and Stanley Tucci and Isabella Rossellini. Anyway, it's an incredible film, but he was sort of visibly excited by the fact that his favourite adaptation of his own work had just happened and is coming out, you know, in the next few weeks. So this could either be about one of your books, or it could be any screen adaptation of anything that you've been really impressed by.
I mean, that's a tough one. I mean, are you allowed Apocalypse Now? I mean, that's an adaptation of Heart of Darkness, but it stretches it quite far. The Godfather. I mean, The Godfather is not a great book. It's not a great written book. I loved it when I first read it when I was 12 or 13. I wasn't old enough to be allowed in to see the movie, but nobody stopped me reading the book. So it was quite important to me. But then when you see the movie, you go, whoa, this is so much better than the book. So that's when it stands out. My own work, I would say I was really, it's not really an adaptation per se because it was written for the screen, but I did a 10-minute monologue for Brian Cox, the actor. I always have to say that now.
You do.
You always have to say that now. The actor, not the astrophysicist. I did a 10-minute monologue during lockdown, which was put on, streamed on YouTube. And it's basically Rebus in lockdown and how would he cope? Yeah. And Brian Cox did such a terrific job just looking to camera and doing this 10-minute monologue. That's possibly my favourite.
Is there an idea for a book or for a character or for a plot that you've ever looked at with envy and thought, oh, I wish I'd come up with that?
Oh, all the time. I mean, all the time. I thought Gone Girl was an extraordinary piece of work. I couldn't see how she'd quite done it. I had to read it two or three times to work out the mechanics of it. So, you know, just physically, I think it's an exceptional piece of work. The Name of the Rose is a terrific. I remember reading it when I was young, thinking I could never write that book.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
I could never write that book. I mean, Umberto Eco was an absolute genius. And yet, it's basically Sherlock Holmes. It's Sherlock Holmes in a monastery,
right.
You know. It's brilliant. And, you know, Sean Connery in the film played him pretty much like that. There's so many. I mean, you know, whenever I read economical books. So, for example, Miss Jean Brodie, 125 pages, I could never do it. Graham Greene's best books, under 200 pages, I just go, these are works of genius that you can read and reread and you'll get something new from them every single time. They are little TARDISes. They are bigger on the inside than the outside.
Do you think your next book will be shorter than 320 pages?
Yeah.
Do you know what it is?
No, I've got absolutely no idea. I mean, it'll be a while because my wife wants me to take next year off. We're going to go travelling.
Okay, that's great. Final question. You are throwing a fantasy dinner party. You can invite three authors, living or dead. Who's coming?
Robert Louis Stevenson. And I've got a specific reason for inviting them. I mean, one is to curse him because he nearly killed me. Earlier this year, I was in Samoa. And I went to visit his house. He's lived his last 4 years in Samoa. Having visited his house, which is now a museum, you can climb up this very steep hill to where he's buried. It was like 30-odd degrees heat. It was the middle of the day. I didn't have a hat or any water. It was 89% humidity. Off I went. After half
That's
an hour...
convention again.
Yeah, again. You know, after half an hour, I thought I was going to die. It took me almost an hour to climb this hill. And at the top, I was sweating buckets and cursing him out for everything. But I really wanted to invite him along because I want to ask him what was in the first draft of Jekyll and Hyde. Because famously, he read it out to his wife. She said, no, that's all wrong. It's not right. And he put it on the fire. And he burnt it. I just want to know what was in it. What did she think was wrong with it that he had to then rewrite it from scratch?
Oh,
so he'd be there. Okay. Muriel Spark would be there. I think Muriel and him would get on great or else they'd fall out. But hey ho, it'd be sparks would be burnt. It would be sparks when you got Muriel Spark and Robert Louis Stevenson. And I would love to rematch with my old mucker, William McIlvaney, who was a big influence on me in the early days, died too young. And also he died as he was just starting to think about doing another crime novel with his character, Laidlaw. And I ended up writing that book. So I just wanted to see what he thought of it.
I read that. I loved that book. And I remember when I was reading it, was there anything at the back of your mind going, I'm not sure about doing this, about writing what effectively a story started by someone that I look up to?
Throughout the process, I thought, I'm not sure I can do this. And I said to his publisher, Canongate, I said, look, if at the end of this, I don't think it's right, we're not doing it. You know, they said, yeah, fine, but give it a go. His widow, Siobhan, really wanted me to have first dibs at trying it. And then she wrote me this lovely letter. I mean, having seen the manuscript, she said, oh, you know, you brought him back to me.
Oh, yeah.
I felt as I was reading it on the sofa that Willie was sitting next to me. And I just thought, well, job done. But it was not an easy book to write.
Ian, thank you very much indeed. It's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Midnight in Blue is published by Orion. And it's out now. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email booksoftheyear@yahoo.com or via the socials. We'll be back next week when our guest will be international best-selling author Matt Haig. Until then, thank you for listening.